Good morning. May it please the Court, my name is Richard Kaiser. I'm here representing the appellant, Vicente Ramirez-Mendoza. In a case that comes before the Court as a result of his plea to a marijuana conspiracy, which was rather unremarkable, but for a kidnapping which occurred in the course of the conspiracy. The kidnapping count against Mr. Ramirez-Mendoza was dismissed. The appellant pled guilty just to the marijuana conspiracy. However, the kidnapping became a focal point of the sentencing on the marijuana conspiracy case. As the government argued, it was relevant conduct and ought to be considered and punished appropriately.
Was the coercion argument in mitigation clearly presented to the court? And was the court's failure to explicitly decide it ever pointed out to the court during the sentencing hearing?
Your Honor, other than remarks made during the sentencing hearing, prior to ruling, no, it was not pointed out to the court that the coercion argument was out there. It was raised extensively in the written briefs, the sentencing memorandums that had been provided to the court prior to the sentencing, not only talking about the coercion itself, but going on about what the case law said about it and in fact, what the sentencing guidelines said about it. Did I answer that for you? Okay. Thank you. Let me just wrap up that coercion issue since Judge Rovner brought it up. This court will uphold a sentencing exercise of discretion where it is confident that the sentencing court entertained and gave meaningful consideration to legitimate arguments raised by the defendant. Here, the record is absolutely silent as to whether Judge Randa did in fact consider the coercion defense when he chose the sentence that he did. Now, the government's position on this, it seems to me, is that you can take a statement made by the sentencing judge, which is very general in nature, talking about how he did not believe the defendant could disassociate himself from the kidnapping as a result of certain admissions made at the time of plea, that encompasses Judge Randa's rejection of the coercion defense as being incredible. That asks this court to engage in too much speculation. The remarks that the government points to never mention coercion at all. In fact, it seems to be more related to, again, whether or not the defendant had made certain admissions at the time of plea, which made the kidnapping foreseeable and therefore made it a proper subject for punishment. It seems to me that the cases we cite in our brief, Miranda and Cunningham, point to the very danger that's demonstrated in this case, that you cannot speculate as to whether or not a judge in this situation considered the defense or not. And it's also would be inappropriate, it seems to me, for another reason. The question here wasn't whether or not there was coercion that the appellant had suffered. It was to what degree had he been coerced. The government itself, at least twice during the sentencing hearing, acknowledged that Mr. Ramirez-Mendoza would have been subject to pressure to try to collect this debt. And so it's simply a question of how much and whether that rose to the level of coercion. It seems to me unlikely that Judge Randa would have, in a very general statement, dismissed what really amounted to, not a stipulated fact, but a fact that the parties, at least to a certain extent, had agreed on. Therefore, I think on that basis alone, that the record doesn't evidence that the court considered that defense, resentencing is necessary. But getting back to my original and the first issue raised in this case, and that's whether or not the court relied on erroneous information when it found that this kidnapping was in fact foreseeable by Mr. Ramirez-Mendoza and therefore he should be punished for same. The crux of the issue is that the government argued and the court adopted the position that Mr. Ramirez-Mendoza had adopted and agreed to certain facts that were found in the plea agreement and the attachment thereto when entering a plea. The specific paragraphs the government pointed to were summaries, if you will, of what the government intended to prove by expert testimony had the case gone to trial, specifically what kinds of practices a drug trafficking organization of this type would engage in, including, they said their expert would say, use of guns, threatening conduct, and kidnapping. Because the court found that Mr. Ramirez-Mendoza adopted those three paragraphs from the plea agreement, it essentially found it was that he could not argue that he couldn't foresee the kidnapping. The problem is that at time of the entry of plea, the appellant, through me, specifically excluded certain kinds of facts from those otherwise adopted, including this set of facts. In fact, one of the paragraphs the government relies on, which they say indicates knowledge on Mr. Ramirez-Mendoza's part to the kind of practices a drug trafficking organization would engage in, is the very one I raised at the time of plea and indicated that the appellant was not adopting those facts, that was the government's theory, that they may very well have planned to introduce expert testimony on that, but that the appellant was not adopting them.
Well, there were other admissions in the statement of facts that went to foreseeability, and you didn't challenge those in the plea colloquy, did you?
The problem we have with that, no. The only ones I challenged, Your Honor, were the ones.
Was that one, yes. That one paragraph?
The problem with looking at other parts of that attachment A that spell out the facts of the case and saying they establish foreseeability is that those kinds of findings were not made by the sentencing court. We don't know what, other than these admissions that I had objected to, the sentencing court relied on. That, again, would be pure speculation. And it can make a significant difference here. The judge is suggesting that this court could look at the statement of facts and say, well, forget about the ones they objected to, the rest establish foreseeability. This is a problem you run into. First of all, the law in this circuit is that generally this court doesn't do that. It leaves initial findings of fact for the district court. But more importantly is that we don't know what was going on in Judge Randa's mind in terms of those facts. He found a certain sentence was appropriate based on his finding that my client knew from the get-go what kind of organization he was getting involved with, and so 144 months was appropriate. Had he considered not those facts but other ones, we don't know what his sentence would have been. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Coyne?
May it please the court, Mr. Kaiser. Good morning. My name is Jonathan Koenig. I represent the United States in this appeal. And like Mr. Kaiser, I'd like to focus on the reasonable foreseeability issue because I think, to some extent, the district judge's finding on this issue also explains his disposition of the duress argument and the above-guideline sentence that he imposed in this case.
Look, isn't there significant evidence of coercion here with, you know, Attachment A even acknowledges that the defendant as a supplier would be held responsible for the drug trafficking debt for the debt by the organization, and that the pressure, you know, that's brought to bear on conspirators like this fellow often includes threats against the family, kidnappings, physical torture, murder, God only knows what. So how can we possibly consider this case the type in which anyone acquainted with the facts would have known without being told why? Why? The judge doesn't accept this argument. Why does he accept this argument? I can't figure it out.
Well, Your Honor, I would say two things with regard to duress. The first is, I think, as a mitigating factor in a violent drug conspiracy case, it's problematic from the get-go. I struggled to come up with a Godfather analogy or a mob analogy, and I couldn't quite do it. But when you belong to an organization of this type, it's always in the back of your mind that you could get hurt, your family could get hurt if you step over the line or do something that upsets the leaders of the conspiracy. So I would say that, but I would also say that we have some pretty clear indications in this record that Judge Randa simply did not find Mr. Ramirez-Mendoza's account including the duress part, credible. There is the statement during the sentencing hearing, which I quote in my brief, where the judge says, look, your attempt to disassociate yourself from the kidnapping is not believable. The judge then talks about the cell phone evidence, which I'll get to in a minute. He says your arguments are implausible. And then in the written judgment in the case as well, in his statement of reasons for an above-guideline sentence, the judge indicates in Section 6D, where it calls for the judge to explain the facts justifying a sentence outside the advisory guidelines, the defendant's version of events and involvement in a vicious kidnapping related to the offense were not believable. The defendant's involvement in a large-scale drug trafficking organization was greater than represented. So I would argue that these comments dispose of the duress argument. The judge simply didn't find the defendant credible.
Yeah, but where's the factual basis for his conclusion that the kidnapping was reasonably...
I'm glad you asked, because I'd like to get back to that point. What did Judge Randa have in front of him to come to this conclusion that the violent kidnapping was reasonably foreseeable to the defendant? First, of course, there's the indictment itself, to which Mr. Ramirez-Mendoza pled, which indicates very clearly certain members of the conspiracy used acts of violence and threats, and in at least one case, kidnapped. There is attachment A, and I realize the defendant is in full flight from attachment A, but even if we look at the undisputed parts of attachment A, there are some objective facts that I think support Judge Randa's conclusion here. There's the defendant's unwillingness to show Jose Rodriguez where the victim lived. This is on the eve of the kidnapping.
Of course, that's not spelled out by Judge Randa as what helped persuade him, and see, that's the problem. It's not spelled out. I mean, you can look back and we can intuit that perhaps that's why, but especially in light of his objection to that broad paragraph, you know, and I, counsel's position is, you know, I objected to that. That basically covered everything. I mean, he could have gone paragraph by paragraph. That would have certainly made it more focused for the judge, but we can certainly look at things that support Randa's conclusion. It's just it's not spelled out.
Yes, and that's what I would urge you to do. Certainly, his statement.
What you know? What I mean is, no. He's supposed to spell it out. We're not supposed to spell it out.
We would
figure it out,
right?
To spell it out. That's what I mean. I mean, I understand when you go back and you look back, there are definitely things that support his finding. But the point is, he didn't spell out each of those facts that he relied on, and especially given.
I'm sorry.
No, but especially given that they objected to that paragraph when there was the guilty plea, and so everybody's on notice, and big disputes in the PSR and the position papers that everybody submitted on the kidnapping issue.
Yeah. Well, he could certainly have been more detailed, but he did.
Believe me, you know, we know where he's coming from, but.
Well, and essentially, that's what the Gary case says, is that you have to assess a sentencing transcript mm-hmm. with a certain amount of common sense in the context of the whole case. And before I sit down, I really would like to mention Judge Randa's specific reference to the cell phone evidence, because I think it's very important. The defendant gave conflicting versions of what happened in this case. Right after he was arrested, he said, I was hanging out in Chicago, someone came by my house, and we went to the house in Chicago. And then he describes how the kidnapping happened. The problem with that is it doesn't square with the cell phone evidence, which shows his cell phone pinging off towers in Milwaukee before the kidnapping. So he comes to sentencing in 2011 with a different version of events, and he says, I was dragged up to Milwaukee against my will and then became a victim in this kidnapping myself. So I mention that because that is very specifically referenced by Judge Randa on page 53 of the sentencing transcript. And I think under a clear error standard of review, the court should uphold the finding that the kidnapping was reasonably foreseeable and uphold the sentence as well. Unless you have any further questions, I will rest on my brief.
The question is, of course, part of the argument is, how much sentencing should this court do, or should we leave it to the district court to make the sentence? And, that's the problem.
Well, it is, Your Honor. And then, again, I think Gary recognizes that in a perfect world, everything would be spelled out in the record below. In the real world, it doesn't always happen that way.
And right, but you're talking to a panel of judges, all of whom trial judges. We understand that. We don't require the judges to leap through a million hoops and have every T and I dotted.
But I would also say, especially
when this was such a big deal, and it's pretty clear from the transcript, like you said, he didn't believe him. He wasn't believing him. We're just saying that, you know, he needed to deal with the specific allegations and spell it out a little more and lay it out.
It would certainly be a good practice, Your Honor. I guess I would just conclude by saying we're not in Cunningham land where the judge's reasoning is completely unclear from the record. I think it can be inferred and fairly inferred from what the judge did say, both on the record and in his written judgment, based on what was before him. So I thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Much time. You have 2 minutes.
Thank you. Just briefly, and getting back to the coercion argument.
That's right, because you're doing pretty good up here. You don't want to put your foot in it.
I appreciate that advice, and I'll keep that in mind as
okay.
I proceed. In response to the government's position that the court simply found Mr. Ramirez-Mendoza unbelievable, again, if you look at the two places in the sentencing transcript where he says things like that, in both cases, as I recall, he reflects back, refers back to, because there are these admissions, adopted admissions. And I think much of the judge's remarks in that regard were driven by his thought that Mr. Ramirez-Mendoza had at the front end admitted to knowing what kind of drug organization he belonged to. And that, again, was an erroneous assumption. Also, it's not sufficient to look at those two, again, very general statements by the judge and use a very broad sweep and say he didn't believe anything that Mr. Ramirez-Mendoza said because there was significant evidence of coercion in this record. Again, the government agreed that there was some applied, didn't elaborate on what they meant by that, but there was certainly proof that this organization was of the type that would do that. The government was going to introduce expert testimony that it was of the type. They conceded that some occurred here, and then we gave quite a litany of different examples of where the coercion was established in the record. So we maintain that the court should have at least explained why it wasn't accepting that argument, if in fact it wasn't.
Mr. Kaiser, you were appointed to represent your client in this case?
Yes, sir.
I'm sorry?
Yes, sir.
Well, you have the appreciation of the court for your vigorous representation.
Oh, thank you, sir. I appreciate it.
Thanks to both counsel, and we'll take the case under advisement.